This one, I think.
Fabulous. Okay. So we have, as I mentioned at the end of last week, we have our marching orders. We have to get through two mitzvos that are at the very end of this first paragraph of the Shema. The first being tefillin and the other being mezuzah. And oh, by the way, we also still need to have a class on the holiday of Pesach, because I would probably have my rabbinic license revoked if I skipped that opportunity. So we're going to have to squeeze this in somehow.
You could pass over it.
Oh, that's terrible. All right. You're going to get put on mute for that. Okay. Okay. So here's what we got. I am working with an assumption, and I know it's dangerous, but I'm going to work with an assumption that not everyone is as familiar with what tefillin are. And I'm going to just go through some of it as basics. Some of it will build upon it into some intermediate level. And there might even be something a little bit more advanced. So just don't space out at the beginning. At least make it, you know, some attempt to make it look good. Well, let's start with this. What are tefillin? In English, they're called phylacteries. Fancy word, never hear it in any other context, but that's what they're called. Tefillin. What are they, in fact? So, on a most basic and simple level, let's read our verse. Our verse, you would think, would give us great insight and great instruction as to what it is. Well, the source of it is as follows. The Torah reads, again, from our first paragraph of the Shema, it says, "Ukeshartam la'os al yadecha, you shall bind them as a sign upon your arm, and let them be totafos." In English, they translate it, they sometimes don't translate it, and they just phonetically spell it out, totafos. Sometimes they'll translate it as tefillin, and let them be tefillin between your eyes. Okay, that doesn't seem to add a lot to our conversation. What are they? Bind them as a sign upon your arm, and let them be tefillin, totafos, between your eyes. What is it? What does it look like? What's it made from? What's in it? Very vague. I'm going to take literally 2, maybe 3 minutes. It's part of an entire different conversation, but it's important. It gets to the question of what is the relationship between the written Torah and the oral Torah. Okay? For those who may not be familiar, the written Torah, what I refer to as the written Torah, are the 5 books of Moses. That's called the written Torah. Yes, there are additional 19 other books in what we call Tanakh. That's the written Torah, so to say, that includes the prophets and the writings. But when somebody says to you the written Torah versus or in conjunction with the oral Torah, we're talking about the 5 books of Moses: Bereishis, Shemot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Those known as the written Torah. The oral Torah comprises, as the word implies, right, oral. These were the traditions that were taught orally for the most part for many, many years. What's included in that? What we now know, and I'm going to give list you a whole slew of things that fall under the heading of the oral Torah, but they have subsequently been written down. So it sounds a little funny to be calling it the oral Torah, and we have a record of it being written down. So that includes Mishnah, Talmud, Kabbalah, the Zohar, Midrash. I mean, it's a long list of things that get lumped under the category of the oral Torah. What is it? So the simplest way to explain it, and I'll use this as our, what?
Off show.
Okay, and we'll use this as an explanation to try to understand our question regarding tefillin. Okay? If you've ever been to a lecture, in a university or a big lecture where some professor is speaking, and it's I don't know, 100 people, 200 people in the lecture hall. When I took statistics in college, it was quite a large auditorium. There must have been at least 150, maybe 200 people in that auditorium for that class, statistics. So how did it work? So it was a large group or even a small group, but if you listened to the professor, you wrote down notes because you needed to understand what the material that was being taught. But unless you were Rabbi T and you had students like I do, where they write down every golden word, copious notes on every word that I say, most of us in college wrote down the basics, what we'll call shorthand notes. You heard the lecture live and you knew that if you wrote down a couple of words or a sentence, it was enough to remind you of the 10-minute thing that the professor had spoken about, but you didn't write down every golden word. This is the image I want you to have in the relationship between the written Torah and the oral Torah. The written Torah are the shorthand notes of what was taught by God through Moses to the Jewish people. Not every golden word of every single detail of every single mitzvah was recorded in writing. Because you knew, as somebody who heard the lecture live, you knew exactly. When Moshe said the word tefillin, everybody already knew that meant square black boxes made of leather and had the leather straps, and one went on the arm and one went on the, and all the details related to it, because that had been taught out loud. They heard the full lecture. When the 40 years were up in the travels through the desert, by that point, what we know as the written Torah was finalized. Nothing after Moshe's death. Moshe's death is recorded 8 verses from the end. And the Talmud deals with, I'm going to put it off to the side, but the Talmud deals with, well, who wrote the last 8 sentences if Moshe died? Fair question. Talmud deals with it. My point being, though, is that the entire Torah, from the beginning of creation in the book of Genesis till the concluding verses at the end of Deuteronomy, which is basically Moshe's death, the only things that are recorded in the written Torah are the shorthand notes of what was taught, dictated by God to be written in this shorthand form. But you say to me, where are all the details? How do I know that tefillin are square? How do I know what's in it? How do I know they're supposed to be black? How do I know that how many times I'm supposed to bind it around my arm? Maybe I'm supposed to bind it around my head going this way in a circular. How do we know all the details of this? The answer is we heard the tradition, all the laws and details taught to us at Sinai. The oral Torah was all of those understandings and teachings and deeper understandings and insights. All of that was taught orally, and it would continue to be passed down from parent to child, teacher to student over the course of many, many, many years. Until, unfortunately, due to persecution, due to various difficulties and challenges the Jewish people faced, a decision was made by the great Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince. The decision had to be made that the oral traditions that had remained oral were going to be committed to writing for the first time. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi wrote the Mishnah. He was the editor, so to say, of collecting all of those early traditions that go back to Sinai. And he organized it in a fashion that made it easy to study. He did it topically. He wrote the Mishnah, all related to agricultural laws, in one book. Within it, different sections. The laws regarding blessings on food, because if you're having agriculture, you're having food. Well, I got to know what blessings to make. There's a whole section about not mixing called kilayim, of not mixing different species of plants in the same row. There's laws regarding taking off tithes, giving part of it to the Kohen. All the laws related to agriculture are in one section. All the laws related to tort law, business law, damages, another section. All the laws related to marriage between men, women, the laws about a ketubah, all the topic related to marriage, divorce, another section. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi collected all those traditions and organized it and wrote it down. That's known as the Mishnah. However, this is important. He did it in a way that still retained an oral, a need for oral teachings. Meaning, the oral traditions, just putting it in perspective for you, the oral law was the elaboration and the explanation of the shorthand notes known as the written Torah. Do you follow that? It's important that you understand that. The oral Torah is not, as some people mistakenly believe, is just a collection of thoughts and ideas that the rabbis invented years and years later. That is not correct. What the rabbis did is they wrote down all the teachings from prior years, the tradition that go back to Sinai. But Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, purposely did it in a way that he wrote these traditions, even though it was topical and organized, it still required further discussion. And all Rabbi Yehuda had to write was, when it comes to the blessing on bread, it should be Hamotzi Lecha Min Ha'aretz. Well, how much of it do you have to eat? What if it's not made from wheat? What if it's, or is it all kinds of grain? What if it's rice? Is it the same? There's still plenty more to discuss that's included, but he just needed to give you a trigger. So he wrote the Mishnah with a flavor that retained a need for oral explanations. That worked fine for about 500 or so years after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Unfortunately, again, because the Jewish people had gone through many challenging times, it was becoming abundantly clear that we needed more. We needed to take the Mishnah and actually write out all the discussions that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was alluding to in his one short, pithy paragraph. He was alluding to numerous conversations for each paragraph. Ultimately, that's what we know as the Talmud. Again, putting it in perspective, the Talmud is the elaboration of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the collection of all the oral teachings of the details of the written Torah. We good? Okay. By the way, I teach this course in about 8 lessons. You just got it in 6 minutes. So you guys are the
Well done, Rabbi. Well done.
It's not simple. And there are many questions and I can deal with it. But this is the general synopsis. Okay. So now we come to our verse. Our verse says, you shall bind them as a sign upon your arm and let them be tefillin between your eyes. Now, if you've heard the whole lecture, by the time I'm done with you folks tonight, you'll have learned all the basics and all the details of the laws of tefillin. Then next time we have a class, all I have to say is, hey, remember we talked about binding it on your arm? You remember that? And immediately what comes flooding into your head are all the golden words that I shared with you, that they're black, that they're square, they're made of leather from a kosher animal and blah, 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 and on and on and on and on. But all I had to give you was a trigger. I gave you the shorthand verse that says, bind them as a sign upon your arm and as tefillin or totafos between your eyes. You got it. That's 4 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours of Tachman lectures. All I got it in is one sentence. That's the relationship between the written Torah and the oral Torah. So what I'm going to share with you about what are tefillin and some insights and its deeper meanings all come from the oral law, all come from these oral traditions. Some of it from Mishnah, some of it from Talmud, some of it from Zohar, from Kabbalistic. They all have a different way of understanding what's being addressed in the shorthand notes of the written Torah. And yes, folks, this question will be on the final. So make sure you got it clear. Okay. If nothing else, you walk away with some understanding of what I told you, tonight is a success. Okay. But what are tefillin? So tefillin, as I said, are boxes made of leather, which is animal hide. But yes, it has to come from a kosher animal. It's written, there are four separate paragraphs. These are the four places in the Torah where it talks about this mitzvah of tefillin. Talks about, in these four paragraphs, so we'll talk about how it's laid out in a moment. But just a potpourri of laws. As I said, it's parchment. The boxes themselves are made of leather, of hide, as are the paragraphs are written by a scribe, you know, like you would a Torah or a mezuzah. They're written on parchment with ink. Now, you can't use a Bic pen. No, you can't even use a Parker pen. You need to use fancy schmancy, real black ink, like you would put in a fountain pen, perhaps. It has to be with something permanent. Invisible ink will not suffice. The parchments are tied together with hair, physical hair, well, up here, right? From a kosher animal again. They have to be perfectly square leather boxes. I had a situation. I could not have been more than 15 years old. So obviously I got my tefillin for my bar mitzvah. And, you know, I was in camp. I was in camp one summer. And I can't say through a fault of mine, as I took off, or maybe was putting on the head tefillin, it slipped out of my hand and it went crashing down onto the table. And unfortunately, the corner of one of the top pieces got smashed in. I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated because clearly they were no longer valid and it would have to be fixed by a proper scribe. But just that sheer terror of that I ruined this pair of tefillin. What was, I'm telling you, it's years later, and I recall that feeling of terror because they have to be perfectly square. The head is inscribed, the head tefillin is inscribed with the letter shin on both sides of it. One is a three-headed shin, the way we normally think of it, and one is an abnormal four-headed shin. Okay, go listen to the class on the Aleph Beis on the letter Shin. I think we talked about it back then. www.shoresh.com. Okay, fine. The boxes are sewn together with thread from the sinew, from like the veins, again, of a kosher animal. The straps have to be dyed black. The straps of the head, when they come around in the back of the head where it joins, there's a knot. The knot is in the shape of a dalid. All different designs, and I shouldn't say design, all different meanings of why it's designed this way. But here's an important concept. The four paragraphs that are in both the head and the arm tefillin, while they are the same four paragraphs, there is a huge difference. If you wait, I'm going to put it on pause for one moment. I'm going to go get my tefillin so I can at least do show and tell. Hold on one second. Okay, I got my tefillin. Here we go. Okay, so this is the hand tefillin. Try to hold it in a way that you can all see it. Okay, needless to say, here we go. That's a better way. Okay, it's a square. This part is all square, perfect square. Okay, black, has the strap in which I put my arm through. Fabulous. I'll try to hold it here. See if you can see it. and block the light. Okay. This is the head tefillin. Okay, I'll come back to the hand in a moment. Again, square box, but there you see a shin. Do you see it? Three-headed shin. However, turn it this way, and it's a four-headed shin. It's not a mistake. I didn't have to go get my money back. It's the right deal, okay? I don't need a refund. But I want you to notice something else on the head tefillin. Let's see if I can get it here. On this angle, do you see that it has lines at the top? The lines go actually all the way through. See that? As opposed to the hand tefillin is perfectly without any lines. It's just one big box. The head tefillin, these are not just lines. When you open these up, right? If you open it up, these actually are, it's so hard to do this, four separate compartments. Inside, if you were to open the tefillin, there's four separate compartments, and that's what these represent. It's not just representing. It physically is four sections of the leather. It has four pockets that are then glued into a square. The hand tefillin is one big box. There's no compartments. It's one compartment, not separate. Okay, what's the significance? I'm about to tell you, but I want you to see it in the verse. Okay, in Hebrew, our verse, you shall bind them as a sign. In Hebrew, it's a kishartam le'os. Le'os is singular. It shall be as a sign, not signs, singular, a sign. As opposed to, continue in the verse, that which goes on the head are called totafos. It's plural. Totafos is plural. Yeah. Fred is like, man, I've been saying this for years. I never noticed that. Yeah. That's why I do what I do. Laos al yodecha, it shall be as a singular sign, but the head tefillin should be totafos, plural. From that, the oral Torah teaches that this is, again, in shorthand notes, was teaching the lesson that when you make the hand tefillin, the arm tefillin, it is to be singular. Four paragraphs on one piece of parchment, rolled up, put in one compartment. As opposed to the head tefillin, because it's plural, it's all four parchments. Four separate parchments, each paragraph on a separate parchment in a separate compartment in the head tefillin. Same four paragraphs, but very different. Have I confused you? Liz?
Is the base that the square sits on, is that also leather or is that wood?
No. It's all leather. Every single thing here is made of leather from the animal.
So it's a leather box on top of a leather.
It's not on top. It's one piece. What they do is they work on a larger piece of hide, and then they mold it and shape it into this form that hinges, right? Basically, if you take one big flat piece of hide and you fold it, so you have a fold, and then this top part gets shaped into that square on top, but it's on a hinge because it's one piece of hide.
They're so hard. I always thought there was wood involved.
No. Sharon.
Are they all one size?
No.
Like when you get...
No.
Okay.
Some are made bigger, some are made smaller.
That's what I was wondering. Like yeah. Like when you get for your bar mitzvah, it's going to be a smaller size and say a bigger...
No, not necessarily. I have the same tefillin I've been wearing since my bar mitzvah.
They do come in sizes.
But yeah, you can buy the smaller, you can buy larger.
Okay.
Robin?
Is there special people that make these? Like for the Torah, there's special...
Yeah, it has to be made by a scribe, somebody who knows the craft of making tefillin, yeah.
But would they be different than people who inscribe the Torah? These are different people.
More, I would say commonly today, very few scribes actually make the part, make the to fill in boxes. There's a, I'm sure there are many, but more often than not, they're the hide workers. They make the forms, they make the shapes, they do whatever. And the scribes write the parchments, you know, the paragraphs on the parchments.
Right.
They purchase the hide, they put it together, they sew it, they paint it, they do all that jazz.
So the scribe purchases the hides and then puts it on.
Typically, yes. I mean, I'm sure there are some scribes, and certainly in Israel, where it's one-stop shopping. You go to him and you say, I want a pair of tefillin. And he's like, okay, I just made another whole, you know, I worked on the hide. Typically, it's people who work on the hides and people who then buy it and then work with them. Fred.
My cousin is a scribe in Israel. And when we were there on the first Shores trip, I think, we visited him and he was working on a tefillin. So I had my video camera and I said, can I see your work? And he said, sure. And then he unwrapped what he was doing and he wrote us a few words with the pen and everything. But I videotaped that. I will send you that clip when I, between now and hopefully before I leave for Miami, if not, okay. Maybe when I get back, but you might find that interesting, yeah, I think he buys the other. But
I've seen it. Maybe share it with everybody else. Yeah. I've seen it up. I've seen it up close. Hoping.
Well, I know you have. I'm not. What I'm saying is, I've got a video of it. I could provide to you.
Yeah, I'd be happy if you send it to me. I'll send it out to the group. I'd be happy to do that.
Sure.
By all means.
Okay.
Muriel, you had your hand up.
Yes. Why is the head tefillin divided into four sections?
Fabulous. Thank you for the segue. I appreciate it. Get me right back on track. So there's obviously many, many different explanations to it. How do I put this? Let's try it this way. You know what? I want to introduce one more thing and then hopefully I'll get to it. Okay. Let's take a step back on this and just obviously this is a mitzvah in the Torah and we don't necessarily know the reason, right? This is God's will. This is how God sees it. However, as human beings, we always want to know. We're curious. That's how the National Enquirer got its famous slogan, right? Curious minds want to know. So we want to know, why did Hashem teach us that? The answer is, I don't know totally. I can't answer that question. I'm not God. However, we can understand certain aspects. Have any of you ever truly loved? Have you felt so close that every moment is precious, where every letter or email or memento was something to be treasured? If you've ever answered yes to that, then you understand this concept. What if the person gave you a ring or a pin and asked you to wear it? Obviously, every time you would look at it, it would remind you of the great love that that person has for you. That's what it is. Tefillin are the sign of a bond of love between God and the Jewish people. That is what tefillin are. Faith, love are great concepts, but they're very tenuous. You can speak about it. You can even think about it. But unless you do something with it, you tend to forget. That's why, as much as I poo-poo birthdays and anniversaries, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It reminds us of how fortunate we are to have another birthday. Thank God. You celebrate an anniversary. Thank God. You have your spouse. You look down at those moments. It's meaningful. To think about it is great. To even contemplate is great, but unless you do something, we tend to forget. There are three basic beliefs, three fundamental concepts in Judaism. One is a belief in the creation by God. We believe God created our universe. It didn't happen on its own. Number two is that we believe that that creator didn't abandon the world, but still involved and has divine providence over matters here on earth. And the third is a belief in the special relationship that God has with the Jewish people. These three fundamental ideas are corresponding to the three mitzvos of Shabbos. Shabbos is testimony in the belief of God creating the world in 6 days and resting on the seventh. Mezuzah, the mezuzah, very apropos, we're coming towards the holiday of Passover, of where the Jews put something on their doorposts. The mezuzah, according to many, is a reminder that God passed over and differentiated between the Egyptian homes and the Jewish homes. Mezuzah represents divine providence, that God sees to it exactly the way it is. And tefillin is the belief and the representation of that special relationship between God and the Jewish people. Belief is not complete unless it's actualized through a concrete activity. Maybe this is the reason as to why we have a very interesting custom of how we put on and take off the tefillin. Putting on the tefillin, as you now know, there's two parts. There's the arm that goes up here on the muscle. I don't want to embarrass everyone, so I'll just leave my shirt on. But it's up here, right, on the muscle, right, tilted inward towards the heart. And the other goes on the head that's situated where there used to be a hairline, but that's situated in between the eyes, up here, okay? But the way we do it is we put on the arm tefillin first, then we put on the head tefillin. However, when we're done with the mitzvah or we're done with services and we're going to take them off, we do LIFO, last in, first out. We take off the head tefillin first, and then we take off the arm tefillin. At first glance, it's difficult because as Jews, we're OCD. Everything has to be regimented exactly. I want it like this. So I would have expected it to be, you put on the arm tefillin, then you put on the head tefillin. Take off the arm tefillin, take off the head tefillin. That's what I would have anticipated. And I see some of you shaking your head like, yeah, that's what I would have done. So why, in fact, is the law not that way? And it's LIFO, last in, first out. I once read an explanation years ago that really I loved. We know that the reason why we wear it on the arm, or a reason that we wear it on the arm, is because arm represents action, doing. We have it situated on the arm, but tilted inwards, that when my arm is down, it goes right up against where the heart is. It's in line with the heart. So you have action. Heart is your emotion. And your head, where the tefillin sit, is your intellect, your thoughts, what you know, knowledge. So let's play this out. Fred, this is right up your alley. Let's do this as freeze frame, one frame at a time. You put on the arm tefillin. Stop. What does that represent? That represents someone who's doing action. But what are they lacking? They're lacking knowledge. They may not understand why they're doing it. They have never thought about it. But they just know that's our tradition. We eat matzah on Pesach. We eat maror on Pesach. Why? I don't really know. Something about a story, but I don't know. Is it okay that you have action without knowledge? No. Don't answer that. Don't answer that yet. You have action. And then the next step, move forward one frame, is you put on the head tefillin. You have action. And then subsequently, maybe you learn about it. Maybe you research it. Maybe you listen to one of these classes and you're like, oh, I never knew that was the reason. That's fascinating. Your knowledge grows. But your action had been going on all this time. Now, if I were to reverse it and then take off the arm tefillin first, stop. What do you have a picture of? You have a picture of someone wearing head tefillin representing knowledge. I know what it's all about. I appreciate it. It's all wonderful. But what am I lacking? Action. I have the knowledge, but it doesn't translate into anything real. No, that doesn't fly. That's not acceptable. To do action without knowledge, fine. That's okay. Not because we just want it robotically done, but sometimes we don't have the knowledge. Should that preclude me from doing what I know is right or what I'm asked to do? Come on, let's be honest, folks. If our children had to wait for us to explain every single thing we ask them to do, you know how much they would do? Right. Abstatively, positively, nothing. They have to know. Why do you? Because I asked you to. Okay. Eventually, that five-year-old will grow up at age 35 and understand that there was meaning behind this. Maybe my father wasn't as dumb as I thought he was. It's okay in Judaism where there's action, even though I don't have the knowledge yet. But the other way around, to have the knowledge of what's right, or the knowledge of this is what Judaism is, and I don't, maybe, and not to translate it into any kind of action, no. Action has to be, at the end of the day, has to be the final part to all of this. There's three types of love. There's the heart, the soul, and action. You show your love. You show it because you think about the person. You love the person in your heart. You feel an emotion towards the person. And that's all fine and dandy. But if it doesn't translate, if you don't tell the person you love them, you don't actively do anything to promote that love, then that's nice, but it's not going to last. It has to translate. Gentlemen, you can think about showing and showering your wives with things, but unless you are going to do it, it ain't going to count for squat. You got to do it. And the same goes for you ladies as well. That's the way it goes. It has to be. So when we go ahead and we literally are binding God's love symbol on our body, it makes the most profound sentence. I'll give you another example here. And what's in our tefillin? So I told you there's four paragraphs. One of the paragraphs is our paragraph of the first of Shema, because in it, as we see now, is the verse describing, telling us about the mitzvah of tefillin. So in our tefillin are the words Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, God is one. Asks the Talmud, okay, and again, obviously, this is deep Kabbalistic, mystical understanding. I do not profess to fully understand it. But the Talmud asks, what's in God's tefillin? Okay, obviously, God does not have an arm. God does not have a head on which he wears tefillin. But symbolically, what's in God's tefillin? And the Talmud says, the verse that says, Mi ka'amcha Yisrael, who is like my nation Israel, one unique nation in the world. Think about this for a moment. In our tefillin, we talk about the greatness and oneness of God. And in God's tefillin, he talks about the uniqueness and wonderful uniqueness of the Jewish people. Isn't that the ultimate sign of a loving relationship? If you in your relationship are focused on what you do for the other, that's a formula for disaster. But if you spend your time thinking how fortunate you are as the beneficiary of the other person's love and how much you have gained, how much you benefit, how much you feel that, yeah, that's how a loving relationship. So in our tefillin, we talk about the greatness of God. And in God's tefillin, he looks at it and says, I look at the beauty and the greatness of my Jewish people. This is the symbol of love. Now, along the same lines, and I know I've shared this in the past, it's perfect timing. What is the name of the holiday that's upcoming next?
Pesach.
Pesach, Passover, right? Chag HaPesach, the Passover holiday. I challenge you all to find that anywhere in the Torah where the holiday is called Passover. It's not there. It's not the name found in the Torah. The Torah refers to it as, anybody? Yes, Michelle. Chag HaMatzos, the festival of matzah. Yeah. Chag HaPesach is not the term. It does not use that word in the written Torah. In much of our liturgy and at much later places in Judaic literature you have it, but not in the five books of Moses. It's called the holiday Chag HaMatzos. Ask the great Hasidic master, the Rebbe from Bardichev. The Bardichev Rebbe asked the question, who had the gall, who had the chutzpah to go ahead and change the word that the Torah uses for the holiday? Man, I don't want to be on the front of that line. No way. How could somebody do that? If God called, can you imagine, we're all going to have a meeting and the 10, 12 of us are going to come up and we say, you know what? We're renaming Yom Kippur. We're going to call it the day of, I don't know, come up with a good word here. The day of, I don't know.
Fasting.
Day of fasting. The day of break fasting. That's better. I like that one. It's the day of break fasting, right? You want to go down in history as doing that one? Changing the name of Yom Kippur? Yeah. I will not be standing there next to you when that falls down. So who asked the Bardichev Rebbe? He says, who went ahead and named it Chag HaPesach? Listen to his answer. Beautiful. It's along the same lines. Why do we, in fact, call it the holiday of Passover? Because the word itself tells us, reminds us, the fact that when the 10th plague was brought in Egypt, God passed over all of the houses of the Jews and spared the firstborn in each of those houses. God had mercy and passed over the houses of the Jews. Okay. And how about matzah? Why do we eat matzah on Pesach? The right answer is because God said so. But now why? What's the reason God told us why? We're all familiar. Is because the Jews did not have time for the dough to rise to become bread. And we were out quickly. And therefore, as a commemoration of that, we eat the unleavened bread called matzah. Think about it, said the Rebbe. Pesach is focused on the fact what God did for the Jewish people. He passed over their houses and spared them. God looks and says, what I did for you? Don't be ridiculous. I look at it and what you've done for me. I told you it was time to go. None of you raised your hand and said, well, you know, I got things to do today. You know what? I'm thinking maybe my schedule clears up next Tuesday, right? Nobody said, they all were out of their lickety split with not even time to let the, God says, look at my people. I said, jump. They said, how high? Said the Bardichev Rebbe, this is the loving relationship. We look at it and we said, what we did for you? No, it's what you did for us. We call it Passover in commemoration of what God did for us. And God turns around and says, no, sweetie, it's what you've done for me. That's a loving relationship. And that is why the tefillin, in our tefillin, it says, you, God, are one, unique, the only. And God in his tefillin says, you, my friends, you, the people who accepted my Torah, who have committed yourselves to teaching the world about godliness, spirituality, ethics, morals, you, my sweetie, is what it's all about. And therefore, in my tefillin, it talks about you. Tefillin is the sign that expresses it. If you want to take it even further, let's look about this. You have it on your arm, and then you wrap it between your elbow and your wrist 7 times, okay? Again, a lot to talk about, but then you wrap it around your fingers. There's many different customs. This part about how to wrap it around your fingers is not biblical. There's many customs. Ashkenazic Jews do it one way, different ways. Sephardic Jews do it another way. Hasidic Jews do it another way based on Kabbalistic. There's a million different ways to wrap it, but they all go around the fingers. 3 rings. You make 3 wraps, basically. It's a threefold betrothal. Threefold, like a groom and a bride. This really is. And no, I'm not going to tell the joke about marriage is all about 3 rings. An engagement ring, a marriage ring, and a suffering. Not going to go there. Not going to do that. But rather, rather the idea of that we are wrapping it similar to putting on a wedding band, that we have a reminder around our fingers about this relationship. I don't know where the time goes, but be it as it may, let me finish with this. There's so much more I want to talk about, and perhaps this will come back. Muriel, you had asked me what question?
I asked you why the head tefillin was divided into four sections.
Great. So I believe the answer is that besides from the fact that it's indicative in the verse itself, but the rationale perhaps is that there's no one way staying exactly the same in a loving relationship. There are times where one mode is expected and appreciated, and sometimes it's a different mode. They're not exactly the same. To do the same thing day in and day out is not truly evolving in the relationship. You have to know at certain points, as the expression goes, who sent it to? Somebody sent it to me recently. How did it go? One second, pull it up here. Where was it? Something along the lines of, here. You can tell a lot about a woman's mood just by her hands. For instance, if they're holding a gun, she's probably angry. There are different, you have to know. Sometimes he or she needs a hug and sometimes they need their space. Sometimes it's a soft word and sometimes you don't say anything. And some, it's not exactly the same. So the arm tefillin and the head tefillin do not have to be exactly the same. Why specifically into four? Another whole conversation, not enough time for tonight. But there's a difference. There are separate aspects of a loving relationship. You don't have to be, you shouldn't be, and that you don't. You shouldn't be exactly the same day in and day out. To keep a loving relationship strong, it requires change. It requires renewal. It requires some kind of refocus. That's part of it. And yes, there are times of where you're more together and there are times where you're somewhat separate. I don't mean it in a negative way. Right? In Torah, it talks about various aspects in a marriage. There are times a husband and wife are intimate, and there are certain times that they're not intimate. There is a level of separation. Why? Shouldn't we always be so close? Shouldn't it always? No, the answer is we're human beings, and we get bored of the same thing over and over and over again. It needs a change. Marriage, every relationship, even more so, requires that renewal, that sense of rejuvenation in the relationship. There are times closeness and sometimes not close. That's legit. That's legit. I shouldn't say it, but I'll say it anyway. I truly believe, and it's not without exception, but I think as a general rule, those who post on social media the lovingness that they have with their person, their significant other, and they have to show the world that this is how loving relationship they have, I would bet dollars to donuts that they are going through difficult times, that they have to announce it to the world. Those who have healthy relationships do not need to show this to everybody. It's between them. They have it strong, rock solid. I don't need to show everybody. Again, you'll bring me this one as a proof and that one as a proof. It's not true. I'm telling you, I've heard enough stories in my own life of people who, if you look at them from the outside, they seem like the perfect couple. Everything is great. Everything's wonderful. And then you find out it is seriously rocky. But you look at all their pictures, you look at all their Facebook posts, and it's like, you know, it's Disneyland all day, every day. Farfignugan. It's not true. It's not true. There, you have to know about relationships. The Torah, let's, and I'll end with this and that, because I can go on this topic for a long time. The Torah is the guidebook. It's the handbook, the instruction manual for how human beings behave. It's not an instruction manual to just dictate, do this, do that. It's just the opposite. It's the owner's manual to know how we function best. So if the Torah teaches us that in a healthy marriage relationship, there are times of the month, times of the year where they are closer and times of the month or year where they need to be not physical, then that is an indication on how to keep things fresh, how to keep things running and peak performance. The entire Torah is designed to teach us about ourselves. The more we understand that, the more we get out of our Hebrew school mentality that the Torah is here just to dictate do's and don'ts because God has an ego problem, we'll finally wake up and realize that this is the best book of instruction for how we can function best. Tefillin is the reminder daily that there's a loving relationship between us and God. Perhaps that's the reason why you don't have to wear tefillin and one should not wear tefillin on Shabbos. We don't wear it on Shabbos. Why? Because I have other things to remind me of that relationship with God. That's what Shabbos and Yom Tov are all about. That's what it is. In fact, we have the custom that on Tisha B'Av, the saddest day on the Jewish calendar, we don't wear our tefillin in the morning. We wait until much later in the day, mincha time. We don't wear it in the morning. Why? Because we're crying that our relationship is strained. That's the day the temples were destroyed. I'm going to go put on tefillin that talks about how much we love each other. We're in the middle of a heated argument. God has just given us a swift kick in the toches. What, I'm going to go put on, I'm going to flaunt my loving relationship? No, not yet. Later in the day, hopefully things have calmed down. We've turned the corner. Okay, I can put my tefillin back on. It's a sign of our love for each other. You got to know when to wear it. That's how this works. Okay, I'm going to end with one story. One more story. It's very strange that the Torah uses a word for tefillin that is weird. I get the first one, that it shall be binded as a sign upon your arm. The word for sign in Hebrew and os is used throughout the Torah. I'm good with that. But this other word, and you shall let them be totafos. The word totafos doesn't exist anywhere else in the Torah. It's a weird word. And the Talmud grapples, what's the origin of its word? And it gets to all the different things. I want to read you a beautiful insight from a Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky that, let's see, what year are we in now? 5782. This is 24 years ago. 24 years ago, he wrote this. I found it back in 01, so 20 years ago. It's the following. He writes the following, okay? Imagine you're a tourist on your way to see this nation's most revered document, the one that forged our beliefs and principles. You enter the hallowed halls of the Library of Congress, and you ask a guard, which way to the Declaration of Independence? He points to a sign with bold letters. The sign has a large arrow and reads, this way to the Declaratia in Zavitsamotsi. In small print, it translates the two Russian words, Declaration of Independence. You'd be shocked. Why in the world would the United States government use a foreign language to identify the very document that symbolizes the essence of America? Obviously, the story is not true and could probably never happen. Rabbi Kamenetsky says, this is why I'm troubled by the Torah's choice of words to introduce us to the most Jewish of all symbols, tefillin. The Torah commands the children of Israel to wear tefillin with an interesting expression. They shall be for totafos between your eyes. The Talmud is concerned with the origin of the word totafos. Clearly, it has no Jewish origin. The Talmud declares that totafos is a compound word that combines two foreign words. The word tot in Afriki, that's the word the Talmud uses, perhaps Africa, I don't know, means the number two. And the word pas, tota phos, the word phos, in the Coptic language means, again, the number two. The tefillin on the head have how many compartments, Muriel?
Four.
Four, because tot phot is two, two. Two plus two. Whoa, you say, wait a second. How baffling. Why would the Torah use a compound of two very foreign words to describe a Jewish, perhaps the most Jewish symbol? Okay. What is even more interesting, he writes, is that just a few verses prior, the Torah refers to the tefillin boxes as zikaron, a remembrance between the eyes. If the Torah calls tefillin a remembrance, then why does it refer to them as totafos? And if they are totafos, then why are they a remembrance? These are his two questions. Listen to his story and his punchline. I love it. Steven Savitsky, the CEO of a company called Staff Builders, one of America's leading home healthcare providers, again, this goes back a few years, spends quite a bit of time traveling on airplane. It's at 35,000 feet where he has met Jews of great diversity, backgrounds, and beliefs. Once, on a flight out of Baton Rouge toward Wichita, Kansas, he was bumped to first class. He was seated next to a large man who had a thick gold ring on his pinky and an even thicker gold chain hanging loosely from his neck. The man was chewing an unlit cigar while immersing himself in a sports magazine. As soon as the seatbelt sign was turned off, he ordered two drinks. All the while, the flamboyant jet setter was immersed in his own self, hardly glanced at the neatly groomed executive who was sitting next to him. He surely did not notice that Steve's head was covered during the entire flight. The flight attendants began serving the meal. The smell of glazed ham that was wafting from his neighbor's tray made it difficult for Steve to eat his paltry kosher food. It was only after the meals were cleared and the trays removed did Mr. Savitsky take out a small siddur to say grace after meals. All of a sudden, a pair of eyes transfixed on the siddur. "Hey, my friend," exclaimed the man. Steve heard an accent, a little Brooklyn accent cowering underneath the southern drawl. "Is that a siddur?" Steve nodded. "Sure. You want to look at it?" "Look at it," shouted the stranger. "I want to use it. Do you know how many years it's been since I saw a siddur? Give it to me, please." The man grabbed it, kissed it, then stood up in his seat, began to shake and shout with fervor, "Baruch Hu Es Hashem HaMevorach," and he starts screaming the davening. The entire first class section just turned around, stared in shock. For the next 10 minutes, the man stood, shook wildly as he recited the Maariv prayer word for word without care or concern for anyone who was watching. For those 10 minutes, he left Louisiana way below as he ascended to the heavens with the world of his childhood. With a mixture of great pride and a bit of embarrassment, Steve watched. When the man finished praying, Steve presented the small siddur that evoked Jewish memories over the Delta as a memento to the former day school student. Says Rabbi Kamenetsky, "Perhaps the Torah intentionally called tefillin a remembrance, and perhaps with even more intention, did it give it a foreign name. The Torah tells us, no matter where a Jew may be, whether it be the jungles of the Congo, in Africa, or the Coptic Islands, the Jewish symbols will be there to remind him to come home. The Torah's observance is not relegated to any specific geographical location. It can and should be observed, albeit not in toto, every place in the world. And no matter where a Jew finds himself, there are symbols to remind him of his Judaism. For there is a special spark in every Jewish soul that is waiting to be kindled. Yes, even out of Africa." It was worth keeping for 20-something years. What a great insight. Great story. This, my friends, is a great way to finish up about tefillin. Tefillin, and I've barely scratched the surface. but we are pressed for time. Next week, we have to cover mezuzah. And then I hope the week after we can actually cover something about Pesach. But let me make sure. I got my calendar right here. Hold on. If anybody has any questions, yes, Robin.
And I don't want to make this a long discussion. I'm just very curious. If the three basic beliefs, as you said, with Shabbos, mezuzah, and tefillin, then why, and Shabbos, women keep Shabbos and women use the mezuzah, why do women not use the tefillin?
Long discussion. The short answer is, as a general rule, any positive time-bound mitzvah, women are exempt. Anything that is dependent on being done at a specific time or day, that's a positive commandment, women are exempt from. So tefillin are only worn certain days of the year. And it can only be worn by day. So since it is bound by time, and it's a positive commandment, the Torah says to do it, women are exempt. That's the short answer.
But doesn't the Torah say Shabbos is just a Friday and women do that?
But the Torah says Shabbos, you cannot do any of those categories of activity. There's a negative. If you're obligated in the negative, you're obligated in the positive. Those go hand in hand. It's the same reason why do women have to eat matzah the night of the Seder? One could argue and say, hey, Rabbi, that's a great concept. If it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, I don't have to eat it. Some of you ladies are like, yes, I'm going to turn off Zoom right about now. But don't, because you'd be mistaken. Because there is a negative prohibition, you're not allowed to eat chametz. You're not allowed to eat leavened bread. The two go hand in hand. Those who are obligated not to eat leavened bread are obligated because of it to eat unleavened bread.
Okay, so but if it's a negative and positive together, everybody...
All negative commandments, women are obligated equally like men. You have no leniency, Robin, to go ahead and murder somebody. It's a negative prohibition. You may not murder. Sorry, nothing to do. I don't care if it's time-bound, not time-bound. All negative commandments, except for those that obviously don't apply, like shaving with a razor your beard. So... And we're not going there.
Okay.
Right. So all negative commandments, women are obligated as well. But any positive time-bound mitzvah that is independent of anything else, women are exempt. That's why technically, women do not have to wear tefillin. Women do not have to wear tzitzit. Women do not have to hear shofar on Rosh Hashanah, but do it anyway. Do it anyway. You have no leniency from Rabbi T on that. But technically, you are not obligated. It's a time. If I blow shofar tomorrow, I get no mitzvah. It's only on Rosh Hashanah I have a mitzvah. It's a time-bound positive commandment.
Okay. I didn't understand Shabbos because I thought Shabbos was positive. Like, you have to keep the Shabbos. So that's
what yes, but there is a connection to the negatives as well. Shabbos has two parts, the do's and the don'ts. And so since there are don'ts.
If there's any connection to the negative, then women do not have.
No, women do have to.
I'm sorry. With the positive thing. Okay. I got it. Okay.
Positive. It's that you're making it more complicated than it needs to be.
I'm not trying to. I'm just trying to get it.
It's simple. Write this down. Time bound positive commandments, independent of anything else. Women are not obligated.
Okay. Shabbos is not independent.
That's correct.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you for that. Cause I just didn't understand.
What else? Any other questions? Okay, wonderful. All right. Have a great rest of the week, everybody. I will see you, God willing, next week, and we will talk on the topic of Passover. Have a great week.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
Pleasure.
Thank
you.